This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There were planned protests in central Nairobi. Many youth came out to protest against President Ruto's government, who they say that he's not doing enough. Of course, there are heavy police presence in central Nairobi. The protesters coming emerging from several streets, but they were being tear gassed to contain them.
That's Muhammad Yusuf reporting on today's demonstrations in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Details coming up also. Russian flags waved during protests seen for the first time in Nigeria may show pro-Russian sentiment is growing in parts of Africa. And Chad marks a medical milestone. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. As Kenya's new cabinet gathered to be sworn in today, thousands of mostly young protesters demonstrated in Nairobi. A short time ago, I spoke with reporter Muhammad Yusuf in Nairobi to update us on the latest demonstrations today, dubbed Nani Nani, or 8-8 in Swahili, to signify today's date.
Yeah, today there were two events. Today, Thursday, there were two events in Nairobi, one at State House where cabinet members were being sworn in, but a few kilometers away from where the swearing-in was taking place. There were planned protests in central Nairobi. Many youths came out to protest against President Ruto's government, who they say that he's not doing enough. Of course, there were heavy police presence in central Nairobi. The protesters coming emerging from several streets, but they were being tear gassed to contain them. So it's been generally running battles between the protesters and the youth in central Nairobi, even though many were celebrating that Kenya now has a new cabinet, which they hope will change things and move the country forward.
And Mohammed, Kenya's acting police chief Gilbert Masengele has warned yesterday that criminals intended to infiltrate the demonstrations and advised people to stay away from protected zones such as the main international airport and Ruto's official residence and take precaution in crowded areas. How was the crowd and did they heed this message from the police chief?
They did. Nairobi, central Nairobi, where most of the protests were being planned, it was quiet. There were no people in the streets except protesters. Many shops were closed and they heeded to that call. And that has been the image that is being replicated since protests began in June. Many people were very afraid to come out to their businesses, even to come to the streets in Nairobi, because they were fearing that some of these protests might turn deadly violent. And we have seen around June, there were some shops that were looted. And all this sort of image that is around protest in Kenya, generally in Kenya, people tend to stay away, and many have stayed away. But generally, of course, many youth have come out to show their displeasure with the Kenyan government led by President William Ruto. There haven't been much events today. It's remained quiet. We haven't seen where we were. We just saw police and youth engaging and running battles here and there. Tear gas. We haven't seen anyone breaking into people's businesses or youth attacking each other, or there were pickpockets, only those sort of things, even though early in the morning there were those kind of incidents. But generally it has remained peaceful. There were no water cannons, only tear gas. That shows that the situation was today under control and it quite remained peaceful today.
And Mohammed, in a bid to tackle the worst crisis of his presidency, Ruto, like you just said, has taken serious measures to address public anger, including scrapping the tax hikes, reshuffling his cabinet and making deep budget cuts. What do the protesters want? Do they want his removal, or are these measures enough for them to actually work with Ruto?
The issue here between the protesters, the youth, the public and the government, is first of all is the issue of trust. Even though the government has made changes that everyone is able to see, like the tax on tax, on dissolving cabinet, but people, in a way, they feel that this government is not up to task to deliver and to work for them. But the government is saying, give us time. We have a new cabinet that we believe it's inclusive and it will solve much of the problem. I think today was a swearing in. Let them go to work, start working, and then we see what they will come up with. And that's the only way we will know if the government is also serious about working for the people and addressing some of their demands.
That was reporter Mohammed Yusuf speaking with me from Nairobi. As you just heard, protesters have again taken to the streets in cities around Kenya to call for President William Ruto's resignation and show their anger over the rising cost of living. Journalist James Shimanyula in Nairobi has been speaking with people to get their thoughts on the protests, which began in June. Rafael Mawara is fed up with the problems the protests cause.
We can't afford to have more protests in this country. My appeal is for the Generation Z to tone down on the agitation and the rhetoric. Government has made commendable steps in terms of accountability. The other day we saw the president sacking the entire cabinet. The president has broad-based cabinet.
Alexander Mulomi says President William Ruto is not listening to the protesters, most of whom are members of Generation Z.
He doesn't have young people around him. We as young people, we are still suffering. What we want from them, we want them to be accountable. We will not sit down as Gen Zs to see that happen.
Jacqueline Okash supports the protesters.
Protests should continue because the government does not listen to what people want. The youth want President Ruto to resign to pave the way for the youth to lead the country through free and fair elections. Ruto has messed up the country. Continued protests will force him to resign.
You can find more of VOA's coverage on Kenya's protests on voaafrica.com and social media. Nigerian security forces have detained 7 Polish nationals for allegedly displaying Russian flags during protests against economic hardship in the West African nation. The Associated Press reports the University of Warsaw confirmed those detained were students and a lecturer who were in Nigeria for a university study trip. The Polish Foreign Affairs Ministry said on X that its officials in Nigeria are establishing the exact circumstances of the incident with Nigerian authorities. Thousands of mostly young Nigerians had poured onto the streets across the country to protest against the country's worst cost of living crisis in a generation. In one viral video from Kano State, a protester held a Russian flag besides a placard that read, "Russia, come and help us." Some political analysts say that may indicate that pro-Russian sentiment is expanding into Nigeria. The country's military chief, Christopher Musa, said such acts constitute treason, which is defined by Nigerian laws as any act that, among other things, instigates any foreigner to invade Nigeria with an armed force. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The World Health Organization says Chad recently eliminated the tropical disease human African trypanosomiasis, known as HAT. The elimination marks a milestone for the agency's program targeting what it calls neglected tropical diseases. Dr. Amish Adalija is an infectious disease physician with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health here in the U.S. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that the fly-borne tropical disease is also known as sleeping sickness.
Chad was able to eliminate human African trypanosomiasis by an aggressive effort at really trying to reduce contact between humans and the vector insect that spreads this disease. That's the tsetse fly. So that involves aggressive use of traps, aggressive education of the public, as well as surveillance and testing to confirm that elimination had occurred.
And how is HAT spread to people? You say it's through this tsetse fly?
Yes. Human African trypanosomiasis is acquired by humans through the bite of a tsetse fly. And during that bite, tsetse flies that are infected with a microorganism called Trypanosoma brucei will then transmit that parasite into humans, and that's how they acquire it. So it's being bitten by a tsetse fly that has the requisite pathogen in it, the trypanosome.
Is there a vaccine for this disease?
There are no vaccines for human African trypanosomiasis.
So that's why it's been hard to eliminate all this time.
It's hard to eliminate because there is no vaccine, and also because this is involving another species, basically the tsetse fly vector, which you have to really diminish its numbers or diminish contact between humans and the tsetse flies to do that. So that's a very hard thing to do versus, you know, the eradication of smallpox, where there is no animal vector. It's just humans you're dealing with. Here you're dealing with humans and you're dealing with tsetse flies.
The WHO has been targeting this disease for a while there. And Chad, how was Chad able to, did they rely on WHO to do the work, or how did that work with the government and WHO? Did they work together to eliminate it?
The WHO has had a program to deal with neglected tropical diseases where they provide technical support, resources, meetings. So that's all part of it. And Chad isn't the first country in Africa to eliminate human African trypanosomiasis. So there are best practices that can be shared from other places that have had success at eliminating the disease as well.
And you mentioned that the other countries have had success. What are the other African nations that have eliminated the disease?
So in addition to Chad, there have been several other countries in Africa that have eliminated human African trypanosomiasis, and these include Benin, the Ivory Coast, Equatorial Guinea, Ghana, Rwanda, and Togo.
And they, I guess, followed the same kind of protocols for getting rid of it.
Yeah, the key thing to elimination is making sure that you're reducing contact between humans and the vector, the tsetse fly. So there are ways to do that with trapping and certain strategies of how you use traps and targets for these tsetse flies to be attracted to and then be trapped. But this kind of general roadmap, I think, is pretty well established now that we have multiple countries doing it. But obviously, there's probably more room for innovation here. And I think better vaccines, better treatments for human African trypanosomiasis would also be part of what we want to do as well.
That was Dr. Amish Adalja, an infectious disease physician with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from New York. Now that both the Democratic and Republican presidential candidates have selected their running mates, the question is whether those picks will actually help boost the campaign's chances of winning the November election. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias looks at the historical relevance of vice presidential candidates and what Tim Watts and J.D. Vance bring to the respective tickets.
With great confidence in her decision, Vice President Kamala Harris introduced Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate on Tuesday in Pennsylvania.
In his state, he has been a model chief executive, and with his experience, I'm telling you, Tim Walz will be ready on day one.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump also hails the political record of his running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. But the former president recently downplayed the importance of vice presidential picks.
And I think this is well documented. Historically, the vice president, in terms of the election, does not have any impact. I mean, virtually no impact. And it's all about the presidential pick.
Scholars explain that because vice presidents operate in the shadow of the U.S. president, their role is often misunderstood and unappreciated. They are, however, the first in line of succession when a president can no longer serve, and key to advancing their party's political agenda. Vice presidential scholar Joe Goldstein via Skype.
Their role is really to act as a subordinate, to help promote and pursue the president's policies and to expand the president's ability to function as a national and international leader.
To a certain extent, VP picks can boost presidential campaigns, Goldstein says.
Bill Clinton's pick of Al Gore in 1992 was a very good pick. The combination of these two young Southern centrist baby boomers really sent a message of generational change.
A bad pick is how the analyst described Republican Senator John McCain's decision to have Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate in 2008.
And she really became a figure who was parodied during the campaign, and I think ended up hurting the McCain ticket. It wasn't the reason that Senator McCain lost.
This election cycle, Tim Walz's credentials and his focus on pro-family economics is what the Harris campaign is betting on. Elizabeth Clements is a political sociologist at the University of Chicago. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
A version of being pro-family that is not about the control of reproduction, but is about the economic support of families, be that education, healthcare, housing, job development.
J.D. Vance will help advance the Republican narrative, says analyst Peter Loach. Loach is director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. He spoke via Zoom.
The narrative they're telling that is, you know, there used to be an America in which if you worked hard and played by the rules, middle class, hardworking family, you could succeed, and that America is now gone. And that if you vote for them, that America will come back.
Even if vice presidential candidates rarely make a major difference in elections, analysts say U.S. voters will pay attention to how well the current VP picks listen to the electorate and channel their concerns. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Nigeria's women's basketball team made it to the quarterfinals in the Olympics last night. Nigerian basketball fans have been excited about the D Tigres team's performance, and many were watching Wednesday's game against the United States. The D Tigres team's Olympic dreams ended, though, when Nigeria lost 88-74. Even so, Nigerian sports officials and sports analysts tell reporter Mike Mbonye in Lagos they are proud of the Nigerian team's achievements. Joe Apu, the secretary of Africa Zone 3 of FIBA, the international basketball body.
It was a good fight. The Nigerian girls did give a very good account of themselves. And I think that they showed some class. They played the USA, not minding that they are world champions or number one in the world, or whatever number they are. Kudos must go to the Nigerian girls. And I think they left it too late. And yes, they left it too late. If you watch the last quarter, that was where they came out strong. But that was too late for them because they had lost the first quarter, the second quarter, and the third quarter. The Americans already knew how far they had gone. And then, of course, at a point, I felt that they relaxed. Some turnovers on the part of the Americans. But sure, they've won. And I think kudos must go to the Nigerian girls.
Basketball analyst and journalist Queen John Mosef says the players fought hard and came back from a 30-point deficit.
They came back stronger in the fourth quarter, even deprived the U.S. from scoring for a large part of it, turned it around and closed in the gap. So good enough, good fight. They were resilient, came back hungry, came back fighting. At the end of the day, at least the defeat wasn't so scandalous like a lot of people would have thought. So, but I'm happy and proud of the girls and what they've achieved. What Coach Rena has achieved as well, bringing the girls this far, getting to the quarterfinal stage, becoming the first African team to do so. So they will build up from here, and hopefully next time at the Olympic Games or even at the World Cup in 2026, we'll see them do better.
Shola Ogunade is the former coach of the D Tigres and says she was proud of the exciting game.
I was just really expecting to see a nice game this evening, and I really saw one. I saw the fight with the Tigres, and I saw the fire in them. They were really aggressive on defense, and they really gave a good fight. Regardless of the scores or the outcome of the game, we are really proud of them being the first team that that will get to the knockout stage in the Olympics. We are really proud of the girls, and we hope they get better in future. Thank you so much.
For more on the Olympic Games, I have in the studio our VOA sports analyst and host of our Olympic podcast, Chasing Gold, Mokbele Yabaro. Welcome to African News Tonight, Mokbele.
Thanks for having me, Hayes.
As we just heard, some comments about how well the Nigerian women's basketball team did in this year's Olympics. What were your thoughts on their 88-74 loss to the U.S. team?
Yeah, absolutely. First and foremost, congratulations to the Nigerian women's basketball team, the Tigres. They not only have gone the furthest in women's basketball on the continent for the Olympics, but also on the men's side as well. So no African team has made it all the way to the quarterfinals. They had some potential players that we spoke about a few days ago that could have potentially played for them, Nigerian-American Arike. She would have, I think, helped them maybe get over a little bit more of a hurdle. But to me, when I look at them, they did everything that they could potentially do. You're going up against the world number one. So kudos to them for holding it down, not only for the country of Nigeria, but for the continent of Africa. They have nothing to be ashamed of. They just started the game a little bit slow, as we heard with some of the voices of the commentators that were speaking a little while ago. They actually outscored the U.S. team in the fourth quarter. I believe it was like 26 to 12 or something. So they came out. At one point, it was a 30-point deficit, only losing by 14. Shows that they didn't give up in a moment where they really could have just collapsed. So shout out to them. They have to be able to still hold their heads up high. Beacon of hope for basketball moving forward on the continent, for sure.
Great. And the men's 400-meter final was, I don't know, unbelievable. Can you tell us what happened?
Oh, my goodness. So to me, when I was looking at that race, that race in particular, you just look at Quincy Hall, first off, the American, who was predicted to win in that race. Somehow he came around that corner, took the turn a little wrong, and was able to still come back from, I believe, a fourth place. He was not looking like he was going to be on the podium. So for him to go from not being able to get on the podium in the last 60 meters of that 400 meters to willing his way to the number one spot was an unbelievable race. I don't even know where his energy came from, Yahez.
The surge, right? Where did that
we saw earlier on in the heats that he had potential, some of that top speed that he has. Really, he is that much faster than the competition in that race, in that 400. But still, you can't come around that turn regularly being in fifth place and end up in first place. So kudos to him coming out with that one. I really was completely floored while I was watching that race.
Same with the 1500.
Oh, my goodness. It seems to me like America, whoever, somebody
they're,
said,
they're who, getting surges.
Someone said, whoever is the U.S. coach, or like basically if they have like a almost like a mentor or a mental health strategist, because you have to dig deep into a place that you're not the depths of some places to come out with some of these wins. So
amazing.
Shout out to the American team for sure.
And the men's 200s, there are four African runners. What are your thoughts on their chances?
Oh, my goodness. So out of the nine, we have four Africans, two Zimbabweans, Charamba and Makarawi, as well as the Botswanan that is probably the most known of the bunch right here, Letsele Toboho. And then you have the Liberian Joseph Fambule. All of them have potential chances to win, but as we know, Noah Lyles, the 100-meter gold winner, his favorite race is the 200-meter. Letsele beat him in the semi, but we also seen him lose in the semis going into the 100 meters. So maybe he's just doing some psychological, you know, warfare, maybe letting Letsele know, you're right there.
You're right there.
But I'm right here. So we'll know later on today. It's going to be exciting.
Our VOA sports analyst and host of our Olympic podcast, Chasing Gold, Mokbele Yabaro, thank you for your input.
Yes, sir.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokbele Yabaro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.